Welcome to Caring Community Voices, where we share the diverse views and knowledge of those who are involved in the intentional community movement. In this podcast, we'll be discussing how communities can avoid getting embroiled in or divided by political polarization.
Any of you encountered the political compass before? Sounds like it's...
I have.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I have. I took it a couple of years ago. I am in the lower left quadrant. I'll leave it there.
Yeah. You know, interestingly, I have... So at Icy Match, which is a platform that matches people for compatibility in forming founders group communities and for seekers of intentional communities. Part of the profile questions has there's a section where people can indicate their pew type. And as I've watched people join, it's been interesting to see that the preponderance are outside or left. And so it's not surprising, and the outside or left is very close to, shares a lot of values with the progressive left, which also is interested in intentional communities, but leans somewhat more to, seems to be a little more interested in somewhat different types of communities, simply because the progressive left seems to be a little more urban and the outsider left tends to be more rural more often. And so you can see how like the communal living, such as a work, live, artist community would be more the flavor you'd find the progressive left looking for.
So with the intentional community movement, okay, the intentional communities in general, would you say that the intentional communities have a tendency more towards the towards one political part of the spectrum than another? In other words, the very concept of living together and living cooperatively is a absolute necessity for an intentional community, as opposed to, let's say, some kind of a homesteader or survivalist, or someone who's more or less going out and doing things on their own. So the intentional community, what kind of political problems arise within an intentional community? Because you would assume, I guess, probably wrongly, that there's a fairly uniform approach to politics, a fairly uniform approach to the whole theory of politics. Would that make sense, or are there finer points of division?
Well, let me tackle that first question, and then try to remember the rest. You're rightly surmising that the left coalition, because it's more collectivist, tends to have more interest in intentional communities in general. However, on the right, there are different flavors of communities, especially in the yellow quadrant, where you have people concerned with self-sufficiency and some of those with feeling a desire to kind of distance themselves from the establishment overall. They often if they're part of a religious community, they feel like that's where they get that that need met. And yet there are some situations, such as not too far from, there's a community that is within an hour of me that I've become familiar with to some extent, as they joined up with the ICMET platform. And they are a group that's, they started out as Operation Self-Reliance, and they bought land. There are like 200 2-acre parcels that some 2.5 that they've split up, and they are legally calling themselves an agricultural cooperative, and they're called Riverbed Ranch, and they're kind of out on their own in uninhabitable kind of territory, where it's kind of like a reenactment of the whole settlement of Utah, in a way, where people were trying to establish a separate settlement in land no one else wanted, so that they could live out their own values. And that kind of gives you an example of the flavor of community that can happen in the Yellow Quadrant.
But that would not be considered like a common purse community, correct? It's not a
sharing
type of environment. So they're more or less, they're still living that kind of, it's almost like subdivisions versus, kind of more communal structure, and where they share a lot of what they have, right?
Yeah. And the thing that makes them an intentional community, in my perspective, is that they do have some shared decision-making elements. Everyone that buys in gets a vote, and they do have a membership process.
But that's, you could also argue, I guess, what do they call those things that, like, condominiums have, house?
Yeah.
What do they call that? I'm drawing a blank.
Homeowner associations.
Homeowner associations, right?
Oh, yeah.
So basically, that's what they have. You know, it's not so much that they're really interacting to a large extent. They're just saying there's certain guidelines that they should meet, you know, or should try to follow. But it's not that they're really that deeply engaged with each other, you know, in day-to-day life necessarily.
Well, to me, what differentiates them from just the normal HOA is that with an HOA, you pretty much, if you've got the money and you're willing to abide by the rules, you're in.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with Riverbed Ranch, they want to be selective about who's coming in, because they really want to have a certain vibe.
I see. So would you consider them more conservative, or?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In a way, let's say they're more, for the most part, I would say they're more, let's say, would be more fiscally conservative and more, socially conservative, in as far as wanting to, be very family oriented and a little more religiously oriented, probably. However, they are anti-establishment in the sense that they want to be outside of the public school systems. They want to have their own homeschooling, and
Are they Mormons?
You know, I wouldn't know the percentage of them. I'm confident that many of them would be.
Yeah, because of being in Utah, I guess.
Yeah.
Because I know the Mormon community can be very, very, people can be very involved with each other's lives, but it's also, you know, highly conformative in terms of, you know, how people behave and so forth. So there's an example of a conservative intentional community, right? And if you come if you come into that community, you're not going to come in there, you know, with an attitude that's going to be run counter to that, unless, you know, you're looking for to stir things up. You know, you're not going to be accepted there. And and I'd say adversely that the same will be true of communities that are more leftist, they're more left leaning. That, you know, if somebody goes in with right wing views, they're not going to be embraced. It's going to be more of a conflict that takes place there, right?
Yeah, you would not want, I mean, like if you went, if trying to go to Twin Oaks with your open carry would not work.
No. So I wanted to actually ask Finn where he thinks Bruderhof fits into this. And Bruderhof is a community, a religious community that's modeled after the Anabaptists, who are like the Mennonites and the Amish. And so Finn could actually give us a little more background. Do you consider them to be more conservative, or where would they fit on the spectrum as far as you can tell?
I really, really don't know. It seems to be. So I read the biography about Eberhard Arnold, the founder of the Bruderhof. And though that's consistent with the far left, communism, anarchism. But if you bring that up with the current Bruderhof people, then no, it's not anarchist. They will reluctantly admit to some sort of communalism. It's communism without the communism. That's what they say.
Yeah, that's interesting. They're also kind of socially conservative too, though, correct?
Yeah.
Because you were telling me that, I think, shortly after we met, that because I had asked you the question, why did you not feel comfortable, or would you feel comfortable living in a Bruderhof community? And you mentioned that they do have certain values that are really conservative, correct, in terms of social
attitudes. Yeah, they do, for example, their view of women. Women are supposed to be in the background, and they're the only ones who wear this distinctive garb that they have, I would imagine that they inherited those from the Hutterites.
Yeah, I remember seeing a video of them, and I was kind of shocked in a way to see the way the women were dressed.
Yeah, and even the name Bruderhof, it's brothers. Right. There's nothing about.
So it's a fairly male-dominated or male-oriented type of situation.
That's my impression.
Yeah. So there you have an example of communalism, but also a socially conservative, which is an interesting blend, because you could go into that kind of environment thinking, oh, this is great. You know, this is common purse. Everybody shares what they have. But, you know, then you find out that there are certain attitudes that they have that are very constrictive, and maybe there are people that wouldn't feel comfortable living there as a result. Well, I think that's kind of interesting, because then you see that. So the idea of this particular presentation we're doing here is to focus on the differences that occur within these communities. So if a community is already people are self-selected to come to a community that has certain values, you wouldn't think that there would be any kind of contrast, you know, in terms of attitudes. It would seem that everybody would kind of fall in line. And yet, is there a sense that there are conflicts within these communities when it comes to things such as politics?
I'm sure that there are communities that are centered on aspects other than politics. Well, they're centered on values that don't necessarily make them politically homogenous. For example, there is there's a lot of energy for intentional community across the anti-establishment. So you'll see some, going back to the horseshoe theory introduced in the video, you'll see some communities that are rural that might have some, like you might say, just, you know, as a short, really, you know, crunchy moms who want to go back to the land and do like herbalist kind of health practices, and they might in some ways match the rural hunting and fishing people who might be of a more kind of libertarian flavor. And so they've kind of got the back to the land vibe that they share, and yet they might feel very differently about women's right to choose around reproduction, for example. They might have very different.
So you can have a community that has a variety of different opinions politically, even though they do have something that's uniting them. They have a common interest in, you know, homesteading or something such as that, mm-hmm. or grid, but they may also have other political points of view that would be at odds with each other. And it's just like any community. I mean, in an unintentional community, you might call it, you know, a neighborhood in a city or a suburb or a small town where people live next door to each other and may have completely different points of view. Although there's a tendency in certain areas, like urban areas have a tendency towards one type of political perspective, and rural areas have another perspective. But a lot of the people that go out to these off-grid types of communities are people who are, some of them are urban, you know, some of them have an urban background. Some of them are people that are trying to get away from the cities, and some of them are people that live in the rural areas. So that's depending on where they come from, you know, and what they're looking for, even though they have these common features, they're still at odds with each other. Yes, Kate.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by the horseshoe theory, because my daughter's been talking about that with me, though she hasn't called it that. And I'm wondering, because I think in every community, and I would imagine even intentional communities, no community is monolithic. We bring our diversities, you know, diversity of intelligence, of spiritual belief, of ability level, right? Capacity, emotional capacity. Every group has many differences within it. But I'm wondering, with the horseshoe theory, that those on the margins end up being very much like each other, what are we finding?
Well, I'll want to get possibly back to those Pew type characteristics to answer that question. But what your question and Roger's is reminding me of is in the movie The Big Short, where it goes through the kind of a documentary of the housing bubble and burst. There's a character, a prominent character, which is a real person who had a background as a stock trader and left it behind to live a homesteading life. And they were kind of, you know, in the end, a little bit mocking him, saying he has lots of seeds. You know, I mean, he was no longer interested, even though he had the capacity to really make money. He was willing to just leave that entire life behind. So your question about the way I have configured the pew types is somewhat different from, as you saw, how the Pew Research Center had envisioned their line. Okay, theirs had on the left end the progressive left, and on the right end I think it was the Faith and Flag Conservatives they put at their far end. Wow. And I would somewhat agree with that, in that those seem to be the most politically active, the loudest voices, and the most opposed to each other. However, from my placement of the pew types, I have put the outsider left and the ambivalent right as the most polar opposite, because they are the most anti-establishment. They are, aside from the stressed sideliners, which is the ninth political type that I don't place on the quadrants, they are the least likely to vote. They're the least politically active. They're people who struggle, and their life doesn't really change depending on who's in power. And so I would say they're somewhat apolitical. They're like, if you had to put them on the quadrants, you would place them kind of underneath it, in the center, perhaps. But speaking of the next least politically active is the outsider left and the ambivalent right. They're called ambivalent by the Pew researchers because they aren't as politically active. And so, but my perspective of it is they call themselves the dissident right. They're not, in my view, ambivalent about whether to be involved with politics. They just are kind of, in a way, like Nader would say, you know, Team Red and Blue are a duopoly that's just kind of mostly indistinguishable on most economic matters that affect them or that affect their most strongly held beliefs and lifestyle choices.
Well, I think especially these days, when you see the two parties, for instance, you see a lot of agreement in terms of foreign policy. You don't see much division at all there. As far as like they're talking about, you know, the anti-war movement is actually championed by, you know, the right libertarians, I guess, and also the far left, who sometimes refer to themselves as anarcho-libertarians or, you know, that kind of thing, which is a libertarian that doesn't have this, you know, all others be damned attitude, but rather is compassionate. It's not like the Ayn Randian libertarians who are like, well, you know, too bad for them, you know, if, you know, they just, that's it. They're more in terms of developing things like mutual aid, and believe that there are ways in which people can form networks that can be mutually supportive with outside of the government structure. So in some ways, those areas, that's where they really start coming together. When you reach that point, even the libertarians on the so-called right will say, well, we don't have anything against people voluntarily, doing these things. We don't have anything against that, but we just don't want to be forced to do it. We don't want to be in the whole, because I used to moderate political groups. Mm-hmm. And I met quite a number of libertarians, and I remember going out to dinner with them at one point, getting into a big discussion, and they were trying to recruit me. It was kind of interesting. You really think a lot like us. And I said, well, yeah, in a way, but not really, because I mean, there were certain things they were saying that were just totally, I couldn't get there. But my point is that they do, their main thing is that, they don't want to be forced to do things because they, as they say, at the barrel of a gun, they feel the government uses force. And that's why a lot of them are anti-war, because they're actually opposed to that. I met someone who was a leftist for the longest time, and he was finally convinced the government, is irredeemable. There's no way the government can really be work for the benefit of the people, because it uses violence to enforce its rules. So it's kind of interesting when you get to that point.
Yeah, and I think that the conundrum that we face is that if we, say we disintegrated our central government, we might then be taken over by another nation's government and would still be just as right back into the same or worse kind of oversight and regulation. So we don't currently kind of have a way out of it. However, as I see the political landscape, where more and more, with the technology, the ease of communication, and the kind of near impossibility that many governments have had about, like, for example, Iran recently just shutting down the internet to prevent, any kind of popular foment and uprising and organizing. It didn't quite work because, I think it was Starlink just came in and set them right back up. So what we're seeing, as many political commentators have noted, is there are more and more groups that can make it easy to dismantle authority, and yet they don't have the capacity to really replace that system, because as soon as they start to organize, they too can be dismantled.
Yeah.
And so what we might end up with, what we might be moving closer toward, only time will tell, is an entire world where where even the most authoritarian governments are no longer able to control their people, no longer able to conscript them into wars, and where people are no longer willing to believe how bad the others are because they can actually talk to them. And in that case, we might move toward a small tribal kind of, which has its own risks, right? Because once you have anarchy, well, you need to have agreements amongst yourselves, kind of, going back to like the Native American situation before the before the European colonists came, there were confederacies that we know the U.S. Constitution was partially based on. Like, I think it was the Iroquois rules of confederacy, and yet there was still tribal warfare. And like, personally, I think our current lives are more stable than that. We're fortunate as Americans to be very far from conflict on our own soil, even if we are, sometimes involved in it, involved in even unintentionally or intentionally creating it in other
areas. Actually, Kate, I was going to reference something, and I know this is something that's really very close to your heart, and it's been, something that you've really, been really struggling with in terms of, the tragedy that's taken place recently within the last couple of weeks. And I think that the tribalism, that Ardell's referring to is really part of where that's come from. Do you think there's something to that? Do you think that the tribalism that, the person who committed the act seems to have, I would say, is kind of unbalanced, but by the same token, they got swept up in this particular cult, more or less, of thinking that maybe made it more probable that something like this would happen.
Yeah, it's hard to know why we are ground zero for both the murder of George Floyd and the violence against Melissa and Mark Hortman, both of which have been earth-shattering for our community. I think that we have one of the more liberal spaces on the planet. I think that my neighborhood itself is kind of a liberal bubble. And one of the reasons I like these online forums is so that I can get different perspectives and I'm not caught up in groupthink from my community, right? So I can expand my thinking and my horizons because we do have, I'm in the land of Amy Klobuchar and Senator Tina Smith and Keith Ellison. All those are my friends. So it's, my kids went to school 3 blocks from where the police precinct burned down.
So what do you think is going on there? Or is it just too deep and is it too difficult to really understand at this point?
Well, I think that we have some leaders here, some real trendsetters and groundbreaking leaders in liberal politics and liberal thinking. And I think that like any political scenario, if you continue to just listen to people that have the same thinking that you do, you go farther and farther with those beliefs. Like pretty soon we've got one of our Congress people, our city council people standing in a park and saying, defund the police. While I understand what's beneath that sentiment, I think it was tone deaf and really created a lot of problems across our country.
Yes. I was just thinking about the fact that in your area, even though it is predominantly liberal and more liberal probably than a lot of other parts of the country, yet still you have people within your community that have values that are anything but. You have police, for instance, that who can do things such as they did in the case of George Floyd. You have an individual who can assassinate political figures based on, you know, again, you know, you can attribute that to mental illness, though I think anytime you see.
But they might feel marginalized. That might be, they might not feel, you know, they might not feel like they have a voice or they can weigh in with their thinking because they're so, because they are marginalized in this community. That I have an activist friend who there's a new book about him. He's a Black elder, and he wrote a book called Rewind, 50 Years of Activism. And he pulled me in conversations with our police and to meet with the union president of the police association, Bob Kroll. And, you know, I sat down with Bob and had fried chicken. Collard greens, you know, and he was trying very, very hard to be part of the community, but people would not let him. There was nothing he could do right. And he, you know, I don't agree with everything about him, neither did my friend, but what T and I did agree on is that we needed to have dialogue with him, and not have Black Lives Matter be a way of calling him out, but a way of calling him in. But the other activists who worked with us didn't agree.
Yeah, there's a lot of anger, a lot of hurt, a lot of trauma. And I think that it's not something that you can wish away or you know, hope away at this point. I think we have to go down into our own hearts. I think that when we feel fear and anger, we have to understand the source of that trauma, right? It's not something that's, we can't automatically think it's the other, because the other's doing something to us. The other is evoking something within us that is causing that rejection. And so we have to go deep in our hearts. We have someone like yourself, you know, who feels, you know, that you actually do want to talk, you do want to have dialogue, you do want to make a connection. And yet you have the others who are angry and who are just absolutely refusing it. So there's a difference there. I mean, the work that you've done in your life and the awakening that you've gone through, right, has left you in a much different place than the people who are angrily denying the connection, you know, who are preventing it from happening. So I think...
Well, and I've had my share of being called out as a bridge builder. So yeah. I've had people refer to me in a derogatory way as the Kumbaya lady.
Oh.
And now what's funny about that is that my dear friend Rose, who started a community initiative called Sweet Potato Comfort Pie, wrote a play about the holiday of Juneteenth called Kumbaya. So Kumbaya is a Black spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when they call me that, it's actually a compliment in my estimation. But I've been, you know, with my bridge building friends here locally, we've said that if you're a bridge, you get walked on by both sides, right? You get walked on by both sides, which that's a different kind of horseshoe effect, right?
Yeah.
But even though I'm not happy with what happened with the election, I will say that had Kamala won, we would have gone very far to the left again. And my skills at bridge building would have been more devalued. They're actually valued more in our present circumstance.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
And I don't like that. I don't know. I'd like to hear from we have some new people, Arena and Dan and others, but I just think that you know, we close each other out so quickly. And for instance, I had somebody come to my house who's running for city council, and I support this person and have worked with her on environmental issues, But I chose not to have a lawn sign for the simple reason that I want to be able to talk to people before they judge, before they judge what I think.
Yeah, that's a good point. So, yeah, I would like to welcome you, Irina.
Hi.
Yeah, you've been with us before.
Yes, it's good to see you all. I'm unfortunately not able to stay very long because we had, not in the community next door, but at our house next door to the community, we had a leak in the kitchen faucet. And, which is kind of sudden, not expected. So, but good to see you all. My partner and I are high risk for COVID and other respiratory infection complications. And we started a community next door to us, just like with two little cabins, two one-bedroom cabins. We started a community that's kind of fragrance-free because I'm chemical sensitive and also COVID cautious because of our medical situations in Northern California in the mountains. And good to see you all.
Yeah, I'm glad you stopped by. I understand when these little emergencies come up, or you know, it can kind of go in the way, but I'm glad you came back.
Thank you so much.
I don't know how much you've been able to really glean from what we've been talking about, but we're basically just going over the whole situation within communities, where there are differences within those communities and how to resolve them.
Yeah, so there's some differences, but there's not, ours is kind of has a theme of more progressive. So we're kind of more progressively focused, but there's many different opinions about what progressive means. So, you know, but thank you so much.
Yeah, I guess as long as those opinions aren't too far apart, right? I know that I have, I've gone to a lot of different podcasters online and listened to a lot of different points of view, because that's just like what I do, right? And it's just amazing to me how critical they are of each other. People who are trying to, you know, identify themselves as being progressive, and yet if they don't measure up in one way or another, they're very, very unhappy with each other, right? Mm-hmm. And they have very, very strict ideas about what it means.
Right. We haven't had that issue here in terms of going to say something, I think, and you're going to say something, but I think just want to make sure you had a chance to say what you were going to say.
Oh, I've talked a lot, so that doesn't, you know, I've already said a lot already, but yeah.
Ardell, I think you were going to say something, Ardell, right?
Oh, well, one thing that your comments are reminding me is that there are communities that kind of feel more cohesive, feel very strongly cohesive because they're built on what, you know, Brené Brown has referred to as common enemy intimacy. But those are very fragile actually, because then once they're, you know, in their own unit, then they might get more and more granular about who's inside and who's outside, and, you know, kind of like cancel culture. They just start canceling each other. And instead of if you're going in the direction of common enemy intimacy, your core group of trusted allies might get smaller and smaller and smaller, and when does that end? But if you're in the direction of inclusion, if you're truly in the direction of inclusion, then you'll be going in the direction of building on common beliefs, where you can recognize that even people who have very different opinions from you still have values you can support, like safe communities and prosperity. And you may have different ideas about how we get there, but you can start to collaborate, and so your circle gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah, and with us, it's not so much common enemy intimacy. It's more like the positive of, you know, protecting each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also it's a small community. So like if there is, it's so small, like there's four of us total and we're looking for like one other household. So, you know, if the cancel culture kind of thing wouldn't really, you know.
No. And I apologize if I came across as critical to your community. Your community has more like COVID is the enemy.
Yeah, and then the other thing is that if, you know, if somebody were to, like, if somebody contacted us whose political beliefs basically dehumanize members of the community, then they would just not be a part of this community.
Fair enough. We all need to be in a space where we feel respected and safe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I
have to run. I'm so sorry. I have to run because I'm I need to talk to the contractor. But it was really good to see you all.
Well, thanks for coming, and I hope to see you again.
Yes, I hope I won't have this crisis going on at the same time next week or next month. And yeah.
Okay, great.
This is the first Tuesday of each month, correct?
Well, we do a special. Event like a special program, but we actually meet every week.
Oh, okay. Maybe I'll join next Tuesday then. Same time.
Come next week. That's right.
Same time, same link.
Same time, yes. Same link.
Okay. Thanks so much. Take care.
Okay. Good seeing you. Bye.
Thanks, goodbye.
Dan, could we hear from you and what are your reflections and ideas and maybe what attracts you? What you may have noticed. Politically, if anything, about the community that you've been investigating.
I don't know. I this is all new to me.
Well, yeah, but Dan, I think you could share something about Heathcote because you encountered some conflict there, right?
Yeah, they're very progressive.
Yeah. But they're also very exclusive in some ways, right?
Yeah.
So they didn't seem to be, they seem to narrow their ideas about who's acceptable and who isn't.
Yeah, yeah. They made me feel like, I guess like, if you're white, you're not really like really supposed to be part of the community or something like that.
Well, I know that Karen was very interested in including people or even focusing on people who are African American, correct?
Yeah.
So you felt that was something that was excluding you?
Yeah, yeah, I felt like it was like kind of like not really including me in things.
Was it possibly that not so much that whites aren't welcome? Maybe it sounds like there may be some there, but that they were kind of aiming for a quota, and you weren't going to help them meet it.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. You know, the idea of tolerance is you can get into a bit of a paradox because as you try to be more and more tolerant, are you going to, how much intolerance are you willing to tolerate?
Ah, that's a good question. How much intolerance can we tolerate?
Yeah.
What do you think about that, Finn? There's a lot of intolerance. Well, one thing that's been on my mind is we can have the same values that bring us together. We can have much in common. And then there's the whole issue of building trust with each other and treating each other in such a way like what are the things that make us trust each other and come back for more? You know, smiling, keeping our word, not sharing someone's private information out in public. What you know, what we hear in circle stays in circle. But some people might have autism or mental health challenges or other physical challenges that you can't see on camera that make it vulnerable to participate in groups, and it's all they can do to show up, right? And already people are starting to judge and exclude. So that's one of my questions, is what are these building blocks of trust and what do they look like?
Yeah, I think that trust builds trust, to put it simply. In other words, there's a leap of faith sometimes involved with this. There's an acknowledgement of vulnerability and the fact that you're going to have to be vulnerable if you're going to open your heart to other people. You're going to put yourself possibly at risk of being hurt in some form or another, unless you come into it with that kind of resiliency that comes from, a faith, a strong faith. And that faith can be many and take many different forms, but it is a question really of faith, I think, a leap of faith, and being supported helps a lot, doesn't it? Knowing that there's people.
Well, and we've talked about, I don't know if this group's talked much about trauma-informed care or awareness, but that happens in politics as well. And, we look to the ACEs score to give us the adverse childhood experiences and things that people have gone through. And one thing that we've talked about is also the resilience factors, mm-hmm. Because for everything that's problematic, there's a solution. There's something on the other spectrum that can help us, that can heal us, that can bring us together across our differences. So we may have that faith. We may have resilience from our family that even if our parents were poor, maybe they made an effort to garden and provide us with green leafy vegetables, or maybe we lived by a park. Even if we were in a poor area, we had a park nearby so we could run and get exercise. So that's, I think, what makes us infinitely complex, is we've all tapped into those things, and then they get blended with politics. Mm-hmm. And our politicians can go really fast. And yet, I've thought of running for political office at different times in my life, but one thing I've noticed is that it attracts a lot of people who just really want you to listen to them. They don't even care what kind of policies you're interested in. They just need a caring ear. and it's a very demanding profession. I think we overlook what it takes to be a community policy public leader. We so quickly put them down without understanding what they do. And maybe one of the things we could do is start, and I'm not saying us, this group here, but, in the same way, like take your child to work or shadow the principal for a day, maybe more citizens could shadow our politicians for a day and see what they have to deal with.
Well, it would be up to the politicians to open their world up to them. But I think that's an excellent suggestion. But I think that, my own particular perspective is that the politicians are essentially servants. And I had to deal with a politician at one point who didn't see himself that way. He felt he was the one, once he was elected, he would make the decisions, and that was that. And he wasn't open to, he wasn't amenable to input from other sources. His background was he was an admiral in the Navy. So he and I had a lot of discussions about, I was a proponent of universal health care. This is back many, 20 years ago. Okay. And he was like saying, oh no, the healthcare insurance companies, there's competition and they're, that's going to keep them honest and so forth and so on. So, I mean, it was a lot of back and forth like that. And he just wouldn't listen. And that's not how it should work. It should work as these individuals should be looking at their constituents and trying to understand their needs and reflect those needs. They may not always come to the same conclusions as all their constituents, but they still need to look at them all and not just dismiss them out of hand. So yeah, that's another subject, that's a whole different, that's a whole different night of discussion. Because I think that the main thing for us to do as citizens, right, as individuals in a society is really to find ways to bridge those gaps, just like you were talking about, Kate, finding ways to actually get past our divisions and understand each other, not to the point of that we're necessarily going to agree on all the solutions, but at least understand why the people we're talking to have reached those conclusions, have come to those positions. And I think that will be very helpful, humanizing people rather than demonizing them, right?
Yes, and as many of you know, we've had a forum at the 92nd Street Y with community leaders. And one of the authors was a lady named Loretta Ross, R-O-S-S. And she wrote a fabulous book called Calling In. And I'm picking it up off the ground. It's How to Start Making Change with People You'd Rather Cancel. And she is fabulous because she goes into, it's not that we don't need to sometimes call people on what they're doing, but it's how we do it. And if we don't do it strategically, we'll do so much more harm than good. And I'm afraid that's what's happened in our culture.
Yeah. And we need to do it compassionately too, right? We need to do it in such a way that
it has to be compassionate. It can't be driven through our limbic system. It has to come from genuine caring and a sense of wonder.
Yes.
Because none of us has, when I worked with students on talking about race, one of the things that we would reinforce every time that we met was that we may not be right.
That's a tough one for a lot of people. It really is.
And when we come from that righteousness, wherever we are in the political spectrum, because I see that righteousness in calling out behavior in all those quadrants. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what gets us into trouble, to the point where we can't even learn from each other.
Right.
But, I will have to get going here. But it's been so great to come and see your work and come join you in your space.
Well, I'm just thrilled to have you here, obviously. I think that, you know how much respect I have for you and the contribution you made tonight. We will be broadcasting this. We're podcasting it, I guess. So we will be loading it up to our website so that it can be heard by many others, or some others. I don't know how many. But we, again, really thrilled to have you here tonight, Kate. And I mean, we can even mention your name if you like, and I can even make a link to some of the things you're doing. But that's up to you. We can talk about that.
Whatever feels right. But I do have a friend who's living in an intentional community, and I just realized I'd be remiss if I didn't tell him about this so that he could pop on from time to time. We have and he's somebody who goes to community events in large public gatherings, and what he does is he blows bubbles with children and tells jokes. That's his ministry. And his other friend who would blow bubbles for peace is my friend who passed away.
Oh.
And they I told Roger before I got on the call that one of my friends died, and unfortunately I learned that they found him in his apartment alone.
Oh.
After 3 days. And that's what we're trying to avoid. That's what we're trying to prevent here.
Yes, well, we've certainly made our efforts along those lines, but let's keep working at it.
We got to keep working at it. Yep. Well, we're going to have more fun. I hope you all come back tomorrow for community hour.
Well, you know I'll be there.
Yeah, we're going to do something fun and unexpected. But it's been great to join you all.
Again, thank you so much.
Yeah. Take care, everybody. Good to see you, Finn. Good to see you, Dan.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
A quote that has long been a favorite of mine as I was a young adult and, you know, trying to make sense of the political world and feeling really idealistic and trying to figure out, you know, who's really the bad guys? Who do we really need to be fighting? And what I've come to strongly believe is the quote by Solzhenitsyn, that the line between good and evil is not drawn between principalities and powers, but down every human heart.
Hmm.
Something to that extent.
Yeah, that's for sure, isn't it? That's where we have to do the healing. That's where it starts. Well, I think this has been a very interesting discussion, and thanks
for
getting...
Take care, everyone.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night. Bye. Thank you for listening. To learn more about today's podcast, please see the description below for links and contact information. It launched.